Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is the worst Monday of the year because, you know, Tom Cotton and others have decided that we need to be engulfed in darkness, you know, that they want me to have a vitamin D deficiency. And I don't understand it. If you're one of the people who likes this extra darkness, a pox on your house as well. And so I'm going to be grumpy this week. And I'm hoping that our usual Monday guest can cheer me up as always. It's Bill Kristol.
Isn't it better to have some light in the morning to when you walk the kid to school or the school bus or something like that?
No.
Well, everyone in New Orleans is on such a late time that, of course, you guys don't even. The elementary school is probably beginning around 11 a.m., right? So they go till 8 p.m. Yeah.
We're hung over. I want to shoot hoops with the kid after school. Is that so bad? No, it's going to be dark. But good thing, it's 6:15 a.m. It'll be nice and bright with the sun coming in my window. Really love that. Really useful. Donald Trump was on 60 Minutes last night. And you did not suffer through that, I hear?
No, I didn't watch that.
Okay, great. So we're going to suffer through it together. I thought, you know, it's typical Trump. Trump knows how to work these people. It's a little frustrating, I would say. It's a frustrating watch. Nora, I guess, is asking about hard topics. So it's, you know, it's not like a Fox News interview exactly, but she's, you know, you do the things, and you hate to nitpick interviewers because it's harder than it looks as somebody who has to do it, who's had to learn how to do it. But it's like, are you not worried about the appearance of corruption? She asked at one point, and I'm like, it's corruption! You know? And she's like, did you instruct the Department of Justice to go after Comey? It's like, he instructed them. Like, why are you letting him spin? Just say what happened. Anyway, so I got a little frustrated with that. We'll start here with you, Bill. There was a question from Nora about 2028, and on TV, they played the short answer, which is him talking about how he's got a good bench and how people really would love for him to run, et cetera. And then it cuts off. But if you go to and this is apparently allowed now, I guess there's a longer answer that's online. That you read the transcript. And in this long answer, Trump talks about how he won in 2020 by a lot, how Jasmine Crockett is low IQ. And then he pivots into the 60 Minutes lawsuit. 60 Minutes didn't ask him about the 60 Minutes lawsuit. He just starts talking about it randomly after a question about 2028. And actually, 60 Minutes paid me a lot of money. And you don't have to put this on because I don't want to embarrass you. I think you have a great new leader, frankly, who's the young woman that's leading your whole enterprise. Is great from what I know. I don't know her, but I hear she's a great person. But 60 Minutes was forced to pay me a lot of money because they took her answer out that was so bad. It was election changing. Two nights before the election, they put a new answer in and they paid me a lot of money for that. You can't have fake news. You got to have legit news. It is fake news that they didn't air that. Like, they didn't air that. Like, there's supposed to be a news organization, and there's a whole conversation about how their news organization folded to his extortion, and they just tried to pretend like it didn't exist. Should I not be enraged about this? Should we sue? I feel like we should sue, Bill. I want to sue them. I feel like the Bulwark has been harmed by the fact that they did not air that.
I'll call some of our lawyer friend, Ryan Goodman, who was on with me yesterday, distinguished law professor at NYU. I'm sure he'd be happy to take this suit. Maybe there's some standing issues, you know, and damages. How much were we damaged by that? We could be hundreds of millions.
Damaged significantly.
Hundreds
I mean,
of millions
Barry
of dollars.
Weiss got $150 million out of the deal. So I think I feel like I was damaged at least $150 million. I mean, I guess if I would have gone along with this this was an election-changing edit by 60 Minutes, it's unclear how that exists since Donald Trump won the election, right? Didn't Donald Trump win? So I don't know how it could have been an election-changing answer.
Yeah,
and then this new supposed news magazine pays him off as a reward for paying him off, gets an interview with him, and then doesn't air any of the discussion of the payoff. It doesn't feel like free press, I wouldn't say.
Doesn't he, in the middle of this, okay, some merger that the parent organization, CBS, is very interested in? Maybe they should disclose that. I don't know. Just like simple-minded of me to think that, I'm sure. Incidentally, but he also says they didn't air the 2020 election stuff entirely, right? That he goes on about the election being
stolen. No, they didn't air it at all. Yeah.
So what do you make of that? I mean, that is, I have assumed for 5 years that, you know, he knows he's lying and he's just, this is a core lie. He's got to stick with it. And he sort of repeats it when he has to. But I don't know, when you bring it up that way, just out of nowhere, maybe does he believe it? This is an honest question. What do you think?
You remember the Seinfeld where Costanza is given, I think he was giving Jerry advice on how to beat the lie detector. And he says, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Oh, that's good.
I think it's that situation. I think he's convinced himself a little bit. You know, I bet he could pass.
Yeah.
I think at some level he knows it's not true, but I bet he could pass a lie detector because he's so convinced himself over the time. That'd be my theory. I don't know. But like, again, you would think that I don't know what this would do at this point. So it's kind of like I'm just barking at the moon a little bit over this, over nothing. But like, I don't know. The president of the United States advances on your news magazine an absurd, ridiculous lie about how he won the 2020 election by a lot. You'd feel like there'd be a journalistic obligation to kind of discuss that a little bit.
Right, because A, if it's in his mind, that tells you something about the state of his mind, because it's so beyond, right. I mean, we understand all the demagogy and the normal grifting and lying, but this is pretty far down the road of just believing in something that's ludicrously, so obviously untrue and has been extensively investigated and isn't just a slightly oddball conspiracy theory. You know, it's like really kind of important theory, kind of led to important events in January 6, 2021. And it's actually important now, because what does it imply about the next 3 years, right? I mean,
so if you ask Colin about the 2028 election, she's like, I don't know. I'm thinking about running. I might run. Dems have a good bench. The moon is made of cheese, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you think the interviewer would be like, wait, the moon is made of cheese? Like, why are you bringing that up? Like, that's essentially what happened. He just like brings it up apropos of nothing.
It also implies that he's going to spend the next 3 years – this happened, remember, when he was president in his account, 2020. So he's going to spend the next 3 years preventing whatever moles and deep state operatives are left in his administration and in government, and I suppose in state governments too and everywhere, from doing this again, which means the degree to which he is going to be focused on rigging the 2028 election his way, if I can put it that way, ensuring the 2020, which was a free and fair and honest election, doesn't happen again.
Yes.
I think that's newsworthy too, right? It's not just worse than the moon made of cheese, because that's kind of abstract, you know. This is like—
Great point. It's relevant to the policy that the government is running. Great point. You're right. He gives some bad answers. I want to just go through rapid fire really quick. Nora asked about the cost of living. She says this, and to people that say they're struggling with the cost of living expenses, what could you do about that? Trump replies, well, let me just say cashless bail is a disaster. It's got to be changed. Sanctuary cities really have to be changed. When I saw that clip, I was like, okay, I don't. Maybe he was referencing something previous. And then I went to and watched the whole thing. And eventually he does come back around to the cost of living question. He blames Biden, offers no solutions. That seems like a real vulnerability for him, I think, over time. No? For the Republicans, you can't answer that question. They don't even have like a, right. a pat bullshit response to what they're doing about the cost of living. Like, you think they'd be at least like, oh, we got a plan. You know, 2 weeks.
Why is he even? What is cashless bail doing in there? Is that if he hears that he hears cost and it triggers something in his mind about we don't like cashless bail. The cost of cashless bail has gone up a lot. It's I blame Biden for it. You know, cashless bail was cheap under Trump. I mean, I don't know. We are at a level of ludicrous. I've always disliked the Trump's losing it. You know, doesn't have all his marbles. He's losing it. He's, you know, I just think that's a, we need to take him seriously in the sense that he's such a danger and maybe he's a little slower than he was 4 years ago. But you hear an answer like that, you think, I don't know, right?
Okay, on things that you don't know about, which one should I do next? How about the Changpeng Zhao? He's the Chinese national that we pardoned that is doing business with the Trump family. Nora did ask about this. This is the one time Trump seemed to get a little flustered. And he gives a couple answers. First, he's like, are you ready? I don't know who he is. I know he got a 4-month sentence or something like that. I heard it was a Biden witch hunt. Nora follows up. Then he's like, well, here's the thing. I knew nothing about it because I'm too busy doing the other thing, which I think means the job of being president, I guess. His kids goes on talking about how his kids are focused on crypto and how it's important that America is strong in crypto. You know, there wasn't anything particularly from that answer that I think was useful, except for the fact that, like, that is obviously a lie, right? And, you know, as far as, like, this guy getting pardoned who's doing a $2 billion business deal with the family on crypto, I kind of just want to put a pin in that and keep mentioning it because it feels like something that will eventually come back around, particularly if the Democrats are back in power in 2026, at least in the House. Feels like something to investigate. Like, how did he get pardoned exactly? We didn't really get that answer. Like, Trump is like, I don't know who he is. My kids are doing a business deal with him. So I guess I just pardoned him. But like, who recommended it? Was it the kids? Was it, you know... Was it David Balsack? Was it your crypto, you know, czar? So I don't know. Anything on Changpeng Zhao, CZ?
I love the I don't know who he is as kind of the all-purpose, Trump said this a long time, I think, way of ducking questions. Just say you don't know anything about it, even though you literally pardoned this guy. He's only pardoned one guy, I think, in the last couple of weeks. He's the only guy. He's the crypto guy who's basically funneling billions of dollars probably bad of criminal money to whatever, I don't know, money of unregulated money, let's say, to, is it his son who's on the board? I can't even, I've lost track of all the,
Yeah, crime. Both kids.
So,
yeah,
I mean,
kids. All yeah. of the kids, actually. Barron, I think, is in on this.
But on your more, on the more substantive point of this, a friend of mine who's not, you know, that political and policy guy, said, you know, I just, the corruption thing, I just think you guys and the Democrats need to hit this more. It's so massive. How could you even raise it? I mean, it's like such a scale of billions of dollars and money laundering and stuff that it's not like he stole $120,000 from this, you know, or he was bribed for $80,000 for this deal. But yeah. maybe it is massive enough and pervasive enough that it could break through. Do you think it, what do you think about that?
I think that the corruption stuff overall is absolutely a big deal. And I think it's a big deal substantively. And, you know, anybody you talk to that's an expert on this stuff globally, you know, says the corruption is something that can bring down the autocrats. Obviously, there have been times where corruption hasn't brought down the autocrats because corruption is kind of right, part and parcel with being an autocrat. You know, so I've been somewhat optimistic about that. The crypto thing, it's just a weakness of it. Of using it is that Democrats don't understand it. Journalists don't really understand it, right? A lot of pundits don't really understand it. So it makes it challenging for people to make a compelling political argument because they feel lost and uncertain in talking about it. So A, I like my recommendation to Democrats is to like learn about this a little bit more. Some people have been good on it. Chris Murphy's been good on it. It's not that complicated. If Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump can figure out how crypto works, you can figure out how crypto works. I guess I would just say that's That said, I've become more bullish on it. That deciding to win memo, there's like one of the sub points of it was like a poll that they took where they were asking people, you know, about various issues and what their views on. The second most unpopular issue, I don't have it in front of me. I think it was like, I think the first was like regulating IVF. It was something, birth control, regulating birth control. It was something in that reproductive space was the Republicans' most unpopular position. The next was Trump having a national cryptocurrency. And like the way that they framed it, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe people were reading it as like Trump is making an official government cryptocurrency with his name on it. But even still, the fact that it was unpopular made me think, I don't know, maybe this isn't as complicated as it just seems. It's just like, you know, you don't have to know the details of a stable coin to just say like, this is crazy that the president of the United States has a coin that people are paying him off with. I don't know. And the fucking Syrian, the new Al-Qaeda Syrian leader cut off his family. That was his news story over the weekend. But like the Syrian leader, like was like said, it told his brothers, like you have to stop doing business deals that relate to the government. So it's like the Al-Qaeda leader of Syria is less corrupt than the Trump family. So I don't know. Maybe that does sink in.
Yeah. No, I think I want to provide. I mean, maybe not so much the crypto thing per se, but just the general massiveness of the corruption, the whole family being involved, the endless scope of it, then all the cabinet people, everyone now is involved, incidentally. It's really, anyway.
The ICE insurrection answer is one of the things I just want to mention before we move on. These are two separate answers. I'm just going to lump them together. Trump said he could use the Insurrection Act. Nobody could stop him if he wants. Judges couldn't stop him. I just thought that was kind of ominous that he brought that up. He then doesn't decide about how he should be getting credit. He's like, Nora, you should be giving me credit for not using it so far. Which just speaks to his, you know, compulsions and psychosis. He also says that he thinks ICE hasn't gone far enough. To me, those two answers tell you all you need to know about kind of the trajectory that we're on with both the, you know, a deportation campaign, but also the military and the street stuff. He still sees it as a winner.
He thinks it's a winner, and I guess he's come to believe it. I always thought there, too, he'd never been involved in anti-immigrant stuff before 2015, particularly. He employed a lot of them. He married two of them, you know, and it was not his thing, you know. Other people we know, other wealthy right-wingers were very into that issue way back in the 2000s and so forth. So I've always assumed it was pure opportunism and pure demagoguery. But I think maybe your point about, you know, the Seinfeld point is right here too, that he now has internalized it and he believes it. Because, I mean, there's no polls showing that what ICE is doing is popular. And there's no way I would say, I don't believe that it's going to get more popular the more they go after people who've been here 20 years and so forth, right? I mean, they, you know.
Yeah.
But so I guess he just believes it and has talked himself into that.
Yeah. He's also in a media bubble of his own.
Yes. Well, that's a very good point. That is a very good point.
I think that his information, like how he's receiving information, I think is more one-sided than even it was in the first time around. And so I do think that like he thinks, I think that if you asked him, what are your self-impressions of like what your successes are so far? I think he would say the 8 peace deals, right. Like that he thinks that he's brought peace to the world. which whatever, we'll table that. And the other thing I think he would say is like, crime is down. Like the cities, like we're working, like the tough, and the border is closed, right? Like border is closed, crime is down. It's succeeding. Like there's less crime now. It's right. Working what we're doing with the guys in the streets. And so if that is your like self-assessment of everything, then I think it's natural to think, well, let's keep doing more, like more crackdowns of the military, more ICE crackdowns. Yeah.
And he yearns to use the Insurrection Act. And he totally misunderstands it, needless to say. I mean, it would be bad if he used, don't get me wrong. We don't want American troops, I don't believe, routinely patrolling and doing law enforcement in American cities or anywhere within the United States. Huge opportunities for abuse. But as a literal matter of fact, as I understand it, the Insurrection Act doesn't suspend any law. I mean, it allows the military to enforce the laws, which is all problematic in a million ways. He doesn't get to order the military to do a lot of things that law enforcement can't otherwise do, like arrest people without cause, detain people without, you know, letting them have habeas corpus and so forth. So, but he thinks it does. And if he thinks it does, no one's telling him it doesn't. And will ICE and others enforce it in the way he thinks, as opposed to what's on the statute books? I mean, the degree to which he's internalized a deep desire to be a dictator, I'm going to not, you know, sugarcoat this, is what you see there, right? Don't you think?
Yeah.
And that's really what he wants. I mean.
Yeah, it is true. This episode of the Bulwark Podcast is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for artisanal brands, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce in a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly. And I've got a weak belly, so that's important to me. And richer in nutrients and antioxidants. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable, and they're constantly adding seasonal and limited-time products for you to enjoy. In addition to their classic box, they now feature a gluten-free and a plant-based box. The frozen treats are nice. They come in special. Worked for me just this weekend, actually, because, you know, my daughter is pretty good about being an adventurous eater. I mean, girls, she'll crush some char-grilled oysters. We'll do Ethiopian. I mean, she's out there in these streets. She's trying different foods. But, you know, with kids, sometimes you take them to a place, they don't like anything on the menu. They don't like what you get them. And so I came home, and I was like, well, I can't starve my child. The pasta is right there in the freezer. Makes it easy. Throw it in. 25 minutes. Boom. She got a dinner. Thank you to Wild Grain for saving my ass on that. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/thebulwark to start your subscription. You heard me. Free croissants in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/thebulwark. That's wildgrain.com/thebulwark, or you can use promo code thebulwark at checkout. Well, that takes us to the Venezuela of it, which is what you wrote about in the newsletter this morning. It's just kind of funny as an aside. You start the newsletter with a reference to, what was the movie?
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, 1948, Humphrey Bogart. John Huston, one of the great movies of that era, which was the great era of American movies, a little bit before you were born, I understand. Even a little bit before I was born. But those were the things you saw, you know, in college, you know, 20 years before, right, when I was in college.
Yeah, the Treasure of Sierra Madre. Anyway, I just thought it was funny because this happens sometimes, I think, to everybody in life, where, like, you kind of gain, like, a cultural something through osmosis. Right. Like, I'd heard the, like, we don't need no stinking badges. Like, I'd heard that audio so many times, whatever it is.
And it's used and parodied in later movies and TV shows and so forth,
yeah.
Right?
So I heard that. I had no idea what the origin was of it until I was reading an article this morning. And there it was, 1948 Sierra Madre film.
I'm glad to provide a little cultural enlightenment here. We actually had a funny, just as it was being edited, one of our colleagues who's more your age said, maybe you should put in the fact that it's been quoted, mimicked, parodied in subsequent movies. He mentioned a couple, but I wouldn't stoop to that level of just catering to people who aren't willing to go back and think about the 1948 movie.
The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Anyway, it's a little homework assignment. I've got to go pull that up. Anywho, you're writing it in regards to how essentially now both domestically with ICE and internationally with what we're doing in the Caribbean and Pacific with regards to, you know, yeeting these Venezuelan boats that were no longer abiding by, you know, these norms of how you do things in a free country, where if you're police, you have to demonstrate that you're police and show people who you are rather than just, you know, kill and detain people willy-nilly. It's how they do things in countries where there is no rule of law, countries where gangs control the streets. And you point out that we are now officially today past the 60-day mark of the bombing campaign. The first boat that we took out was September 2nd. Today's November 3rd. And that means that they've officially broken the War Powers Act. You discussed this a bit with Ryan Goodman yesterday and in the newsletter. So let's talk about that.
They acknowledge that the War Powers Act applied because they submitted this letter 2 days later, September 4th, which is the first step. You have to tell Congress what you're doing and give some rationale. Their rationale wasn't very compelling or detailed or convincing, but whatever. They sort of went by the letter of the law. And now they just decided, forget it. You know, this isn't a hostilities because American troops aren't actually at risk. And though, on the other hand, half their justification for the whole thing is that we're a huge risk because each of these boats is killing so many people. And so why aren't people in America at risk? And why aren't the troops conceivably at risk if they're these so powerful, these drug cartels? Anyway, it's all incoherent as a matter of legal argument, but he desperately does not want to explain what's happening to Congress. And he certainly wants to keep doing it. I mean, again, one of these things, one thought, okay, his first time, I keep getting suckered a little bit by Trump, you know, bombs a few boats. I think, okay, it's horrible and it's demagogic, you know, he's doing his demonstrative little quasi-fascist thing, but he'll stop. It's accelerating, not the opposite. And now he's moving massive amounts of military hardware near Venezuela. And I guess I've lost confidence that he's not going to actually bomb Venezuelan bases and claim that he's destroying narco-terrorist centers. And of course, that all ties in with the war at home against narco-terrorists here at home and Antifa. It is, whatever he's thinking, the sort of radicalization or intensification of authoritarianism once you get going down this path is what strikes me.
Well, the instinct is authoritarian, you know.
Right. War on drugs, war on immigrants, war on Venezuela. It's all kind of a package. And ignore all the laws that might constrain you.
Military in the streets is part of the package, right? Right.
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah, because it's the same. It's connected, right? It's like these drugs, whatever, these criminals have now gotten into the country and are in the streets. And so we need to crack down on it. I thought it was worth noting, though, that we had officially reached the point where it is an illegal war now, which is like not nothing, totally. I guess. The peace candidate is conducting an illegal war. Yes. And then on 60 last night, Nora asked him about this, and he said about whether Maduro's days are numbered. And he said, I would think so, yeah. He kind of doesn't want to commit to anything. And he does the Trump thing where it's like word salad. And it's like, well, I wouldn't tell you what I'm planning on doing and all that. But even to say that, you know, to me indicates that, I mean, all you can do is look at their words and actions, right? Which is they're bringing all this military hardware into the Caribbean. Trump is saying he thinks Maduro's days are numbered. Marco obviously wants regime change. It seems to me that they are planning on continuing this and escalating it, you know, without any approval from Congress.
Yeah, I think Trump, apparently Marco, Hegseth, they all believe they have the right to decide at some point that they want to get rid of Maduro, get rid of bomb various places in Venezuela. And Congress doesn't have to say anything ahead of time. Congress doesn't get any information in real time. It's really kind of startling. It's one, there are obviously gray cases of presidential use of power and reaction before letting Congress know, and times when we've done things and, you know, we stretched a little bit the War Powers Act. But this is a level of just my commander-in-chief powers extend to the right to use force whenever I want, against whoever I want, with no evidence being presented, with no obligation of accountability to Congress or to the public. And if you look at the rationale they're using, which hinged on this thing, which came up a little bit under Obama, if your forces aren't really at risk, if our troops aren't at risk, it's not really a hostility, which is not consistent with the original meaning of the War Powers Act. But anyway, basically they say that literally in the email they sent the Washington Post, that this is, you know, these are standoff drones and missiles that we're not, you know, we're not at risk. It's not like ground troops. Think about the implications of that for a minute. It implies that if we drop a nuclear weapon, I hate to sound crazy, but I mean, from 30,000 feet away and the American pilot's not at risk, if we use a missile, an intercontinental ballistic missile to send a nuclear weapon somewhere, Trump just can do it, I guess, because there's no war powers obligation. You know, he doesn't have to go to Congress ahead of time, and there's no war powers obligation because no American is, you know, marching towards opposing forces. It's really nuts. And we'll see what happens with the Republicans on the Hill.
Yeah, Roger Wicker wrote a letter, I saw. It's interesting. You mentioned the nuclear thing, and it does sound ridiculous, but like, we're testing nukes. Like, Trump said he wants to test nukes again. You just throw that out there, which is okay. Like, we haven't done that in 30 years or so, maybe more. And nobody is actually testing nukes besides the North Koreans. Trump seems to be confused into thinking that China and Russia are. or he's lying. I don't know, whatever, either way, when the reality is that they've tested, like, I guess the equipment, right? Like to make sure that that it launches, like the launcher, but they're not launching a nuke. They're like launching something else, right? But Trump, I guess, is claiming that he's planning on testing nukes. I don't know. I hadn't really thought about that as a possibility enough to like develop a view on it, but it doesn't seem great.
No, and I think get back to your earlier point. I think the bubble he's in, the degree to which he repeats these things that are just manifestly absurd, with statistics about inflation's down and crime has gone away and, you know, just making things up. And I used to think, well, he just makes things up. That's part of what being a lying demagogue is. But I do wonder how much he is, as you say, sort of in a bubble where he believes his own bullshit. And that's more dangerous. I guess it's more dangerous than just lying. I mean, knowingly lying is bad and can be very dangerous for the country. But if he's delusional and no one's telling him that he's delusional, that's not good.
All right, y'all, times are tough. You know, you're sitting on the couch on a Sunday night, Donald Trump's on the TV for 60 minutes, and you're like, boy, I can't really drink. I got to go to work tomorrow, but I need something to take the edge off. Well, we're turning to Sol's Out of Office Beverages. In our house, they help us unwind and ease into the evening without the alcohol or the next day fog. Sol is a wellness brand that believes feeling good should be fun and easy. Sol specializes in delicious hemp-derived THC and CBD products designed to boost your mood and help you unwind. Their best-selling out-of-office gummies were designed to provide a mild, relaxing buzz, boost your mood, and enhance creativity and relaxation. With five different strengths, you can tailor the dose to fit your vibe, from a gentle 1.5 milligram microdose to their newest 15 milligram gummy for a more elevated experience. If you want to try something else, I recommend their new out-of-office beverage, a refreshing alcohol-free alternative that's perfect for winding down on the couch or socializing with friends. Bring on the good vibes and treat yourself to Sol today. Right now, Sol is offering my audience 30% off your entire order. Go to getsol.com and use the code TheBulwark. That's getsol.com, promo code TheBulwark for 30% off. All right, one of the great heroes of our time, the Sandwich Man. Appreciate the listener at one of the live events that brought me the crocheted sandwich. My daughter has enjoyed that.
Yes,
he is on trial, or I guess jury selection for his trial begins today. I should mention that they first tried to indict him on felony charges. The grand jury rejected that attempt. So then Jeanine Pirro inserted herself as the U.S. attorney from D.C. So I just want to I'll repeat that one more time. The U.S. attorney from D.C. is Jeanine Pirro. And Judge Jeanine edited the indictment, downgraded to a misdemeanor. That did get approved. And so now we're going to have a jury trial. There's jury selection for a misdemeanor sandwich toss happening today in D.C. That seems unusual. I don't think a ton of federal misdemeanors come to jury trials.
I don't know much about it, but I've never really can't think of any offhand. Well, it's very important to make that point, though. As you know, Tim, it's very important when you have these National Guardsmen and others patrolling the streets of our cities. No one should throw a sandwich at them, and that they really need to be. We need to spend millions of dollars on a jury selection and jury trial in the District of Columbia.
That is, I mean, we're paying for this. The taxpayers are paying for the prosecutors, the lawyers, you know, the courtroom, the security to go after this guy for a sandwich toss, throwing a Subway sub, salami, I guess, was on there. Okay, well, good luck to him in that trial. I'm feeling pretty good about it, but we'll continue to monitor. I want to do a little politics with you. An interesting NBC poll. I've been committed to not like overreacting to polls at this point because it doesn't really matter. We're a year away from the midterms, but there's one thing in here that I think is worth noodling on. The Trump job performance is 43-55, 43 approve, 55 disapprove. The generic ballot for the midterms next year, which is basically saying to people, like, do you plan on voting for a Democrat or a Republican for Congress in your district next year? 50% say Democrat, 42% say Republican. And in the same poll, they asked, what is your opinion of the two parties? The Democrats have only a 28% positive view and a 53% negative. Well, the GOP has a 37% positive view, 46% negative. I lay all that out because it tells you something. Like, even if the poll is off somewhat, right? Like, even if there's a margin of error one way or the other, like, you can see the same people in that poll are saying, I have a negative view of the Democrats, but I'm going to be voting for them anyway next year. And I think that's pretty telling about like who those, you know, about who those people are and where things stand. And in a lot of ways, I think it's one of the more encouraging data points we've seen for the Democrats, that there are a lot of people out there who are frustrated with them, who also plan on voting for them in the midterms.
Totally. I mean, the Trump approval is the predictor of the midterm vote. I mean, it literally is in the sense that it's Trump's minus 12, midterm vote is minus 8 for Republicans. But the Republicans are plus 10 over Democrats, something like that, right? In terms of the general thought about the parties. So people, midterm, this has been a Ron Brownstein theme for a long time, and I think he's got a lot of data to back it up historically, that the best single predictor of the midterm vote is the approval of the president, especially when his party controls both branches of Congress. And that was the case, obviously, in 2018 and at other times as well. So that's good for 2026. The relative ranking of the parties is worrisome for 2028, if you want to think about it this way, because the Democrats need to actually defeat a Republican, maybe not Trump, in 2028, running on who should govern for the next 4 years, not who do you want in there to check this president you don't approve of. Single most important thing remains knocking Trump. If Trump's at 43 now, the single best thing the Democrats can do is get him to 40 or 38 over the next 12 months. And that's why I've been a little bit impatient, maybe is the word, with all the Democratic, you know, navel-gazing, and we have to have this agenda and that agenda. I'm all for doing that work. It's very important for post-26. But the key political task over the next 10 months is to further knock Trump's numbers down.
I also think it's the key political task for the Democrats in their own coalition management. I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding of what their own base wants. I think certainly there are some rabid partisans out there that want the Democrats to move left or want it to move center, right? Like there's both of those things, groups exist. I think the former group is larger. But like really what Democratic voters want is for the Democrats to show some cojones and fight and be tougher and demonstrate some leadership and strength in this moment. And so when you see this gap where like 28% of voters say they have a positive view of Democrats, but 50% of voters say they're going to vote for them, that's who those people are. Like there's a huge group of people that want to vote for the Democrats that think that the Democrats are fucking it up when it comes to checking Trump. And I'm sure some percentage of those people are mad about the Democrats ideologically one way or the other, but most of them are frustrated that the party is feckless. And so you aren't helping yourself by doing internal factional fighting and positioning. Like what you're supposed to do is demonstrate that you're not feckless. You know, it feels like some people have gotten that message, but not enough.
I mean, I don't know if you could find this or deduce this from crosstabs in that poll. I haven't looked, but I would suspect that the Democrats who want the Democrats to fight, to stand up to Trump and fight, and think they aren't quite doing it as much as they might do now, might should be doing now, they're both leftists, progressives, and centrists who believe that, right? I mean, it unites the Democrats is what I'm saying. This is not like a progressive view. This is, as we know from, I think, Bulwark Land and from, I'd say personally, from the No Kings rally I attended and stuff, plenty of centrist, ex-Republican-ish, never-Trumpers voting Democrat these days want the Democrats to fight harder on a bunch of issues, and plenty of progressives want to fight harder. Maybe they slightly differ on which issues to put first or second, but I'm not even sure there's that much difference on that. So I very much agree. It's fashionable to say you can't just win by being anti-Trump. Oh boy. But you know what? For now, you can win by being anti-Trump. And you should win by being anti-Trump.
You can, actually. In the midterms, you can. Yeah. And it's also the most acute challenge.
Right.
Yeah, it's the right thing. Like, it's the biggest problem right now. Like, that's the other thing. Like, sure. Like, yeah, in the long term, there should be a fight over Medicare for all versus Medicare for some or whatever. You know what I mean? Over, like, opt-in, Medicare for all those who want it. But, like, you're not going to get any of those things in the next 3 years, right? Like, so while it might have been a correct critique of the Democrats looking back, like looking backwards to 2024 to say maybe you focused too much on anti-Trump and maybe you didn't offer enough of an alternative that galvanized people. Okay, sure. Like for that academic conversation, which we can have on a podcast if you want, I do that from time to time, sure. But like for the candidates now, like that is not right, right? Like that is not right for 2026, right? For 2026, it's go after this guy and fuck him up and politically and bring down his numbers. That's the job. On that point, final thoughts on the Virginia-New Jersey race. So we'll have governor's races in both states and lieutenant governor's AG, et cetera, tomorrow. There's a sub kind of interest in that Virginia race related to the midterms, which is, in addition to the governor's race being important, obviously there's been a lot of attention on the AG's race because of the Democrats' deranged text messages, but the House of Delegates elections are also very important in Virginia because the Democrats need to hold that if they want to redistrict next year and offset some of the Republican redistricting in other states. So that, and frankly, the Virginia House of Delegates and governor's race is probably the most important thing tomorrow for the big picture of our politics for that reason. If the Democrats control both, then it seems like they'll redistrict and be able to gain somewhere between 2 and 4 seats in next year's midterms. Do you have any other thoughts on final thoughts in those races?
I'm here in Virginia. I think Spanberger is going to win big, maybe double digits. I think Democrats will pick up seats, maybe, you know, half a dozen seats or even a little more in the House of Delegates to get to a comfortable majority. Makes it a little easier to govern for Spanberger too. So I'm pretty bullish on that. And I think the polls I've seen have a drop off, as they is to be expected, for the AG candidate. But in one case, I think Jones's drop is like +4 or something like that, +3, when Spanberger's +8 or 10, which shows you, again, how strong even a gubernatorial or AG election in an off year, when Trump is the head of the other party, is. I mean, when it, how should I say this? How strong even in a non-federal election, even in a state election, in an off-year state election where there are not any national offices on the ballot even, how strong the Trump gravitational pull and push is. And I'd say the same about Jersey, where I think, Cheryl, I will say this, you know, the progressives, I sometimes sympathize with the progressives when they whine that moderates aren't doing enough to help them once they won a nomination fair and square, New York City, I suppose. On the other hand, in New Jersey, a couple of progressive mayors have done almost nothing to help Mikey Sherrill. I don't really even understand why. It's not like she lost the primary to her. She didn't run a nasty primary against them or anything. She just beat them. And they're sitting on their hands. One of them's criticizing her all the time. I still think she'll win by, you know, more than 5-6 points, but that might account for a little of the weakness there, though.
Yeah. Don't do that.
I know. What are they?
You know, just get on board. Obviously, Mikey Sherrill is the superior candidate here against this MAGA guy who's run 3 times. The other thing, just to note to your point about Trump, the Trump factor, not campaigning either state.
Yeah, interesting.
Obama campaigned in both, I'm pretty sure.
I think so.
Correct me if that's wrong. He definitely is in Virginia. I think he campaigned in both. Trump didn't in either. He's doing a teletown hall, I think, tonight into the states, which is like what you do if you don't want pictures of yourself in the newspaper on election day, you know, or on local news. You're worried that's going to hurt your candidates. And it speaks to this conundrum that Republicans have still in non-Trump elections, which is like you need Trump to turn out the less engaged voters that are only there for Trump. But Trump also has a negative boomerang effect among the voters who are more likely to turn out in off-year elections, right? And so like on that balance, I guess they figure it's better to not have them participate. For all of their bluster about how strong it is and how big his mandate was, like if Trump's was that strong, you'd be in New Jersey tonight. He's not.
Now, these are both states Trump lost by about 6 points in 2024. So you could argue if this were a state that Trump had won, if this election were happening in Pennsylvania, he'd be out there, or Michigan, or to say nothing of red state, probably would be out there in a red state. Well, we'll see what the results are. I'd say if the Democrats shouldn't get too high on this because they are Democratic states, obviously. And so if Trump lost them by 6, that means they ran 8 points ahead of about of the national average in 2024. So in a way, you'd expect, you know, this to be a D+8-ish type state probably. And that's probably what both of them could well be, I think. So the Democrats shouldn't get too excited, enthusiastic if Spanberger and Cheryl win. The Democrats have a good night. On the other hand, as you say, if Trump were really strong, they would put him into a state. He only lost by 6 and turn out those voters, right?
Okay, with fall in full swing, it's time to start looking into changing the outfits a little bit. I was thinking about wearing a flannel today, but we had to turn the heat on in our house last night, so I'm in a t-shirt anyway. But, it's, you know, even in the South, when it's still warm, it's nice to change it up for fall. It's nice to start putting on some fall colors. And Mack Weldon has got all the essentials that you need for fall. They're comfortable, easy to air clothes, designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. You can explore new hoodies, half-zips, sweats, crewnecks, and more at macweldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code THEBULWARK. I went into the Mack Weldon store and used my code, The Bulwark, the other day. Got a nice little black button-down shirt you might have seen me wearing on here. A few other Tim shirts. They are comfy. They're cozy. They're good fit. Feel like I'm looking sharp. I'm thrilled. This is a new sponsor I couldn't be more excited with, Mack Weldon. I hope you guys support Mack Weldon so they stay with us so I get more Mack Weldon stuff on the back end. Mack Weldon is particularly good for guys. It's a go-to choice for guys who want to look great and, you know, don't feel like they got to try that hard doing it. Their clothes are designed to fit your style. For over 10 years, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence, even if you're just hanging out in your sweats. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code TheBulwark. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code TheBulwark. Now to the topic everybody's been waiting for. Woke Bill Kristol. There was some hand-wringing over Woke Bill Kristol. Was it Claremont? He was talking to some students. They asked about the New York mayor's race. You, I think, pretty aptly observed that it would be absurd to be for Andrew Cuomo in this race, considering he's one of the worst Democratic governors and he's sex pest. And it's like, there's no good alternative to him, that there was no good alternative put up to Cuomo by the centrists or by the business community as an indictment upon them. And, you know, now they're going to have to get stuck with Zohran and see what happens. And that seems totally fine for New York City. I want to contrast that Woke Bill Kristol with the Democrats' 2016 nominee, Hillary Clinton, talking about the New York mayor's race on a live taping of the podcast Unholy over the weekend.
If you had a vote in this city, would you vote for Zohran Mamdani? Mm-hmm.
You know what? I don't vote in this city. I'm not involved in it. I have not, you know, been at all even asked to be involved in it. And I have not chosen to be involved in it. I will be there the day after, and everybody else should be too, no matter what happens.
What is that?
What does that
mean? This is why the Democrats are so fucking bad. What is that? What is that answer? Just do what you do. Just be like, look, we've got Democrats. We've got people all in all of these states up and down the ballot. Abigail Spanberger's great. Mikey Sherrill's great. Zohran Mamdani's a little to the left of me, but clearly he's superior to the disgraced sex pest and the man in the beret. So I'm for all of them. The fact that she can't say that is really, I don't know. It's just such a bad answer.
I guess she is kind of former, yes, presidential candidate and so forth. Unlike me, who doesn't have to have an opinion about all these things. You think she might? She's a major Democrat. But that's been true of a lot of them, right? Schumer. I mean, a lot of them have refused to endorse him. Some have actually endorsed Cuomo, which they're free to do. When I answered the Claremont kids, I said something like, you know, I don't live there. I haven't, you know, been involved at all. I really haven't been. Just like me and Hillary Clinton were similar in that respect. You know, I have been involved a little in Virginia where I live for Spanberger. And I said I wouldn't have voted for Mamdani in the first round. I wouldn't have ranked him probably. But here, this is a choice. And I would be inclined to vote for Mamdani. It was pretty wild. Yeah. I think you can have plenty of reservations about him and still say, or you can say, no, I'm just staying out of it. I don't know who I'd vote for. That's a perfectly reasonable answer. I have friends who are voting for all three. I have friends voting for Mamdani, people I kind of respect their political judgment and agree with them on a lot of things. I have people I agree with a lot who are sucking it up and voting for Cuomo. They think it's important. It'd be better for the city. There's actually ran into some people who are voting for Sliwa because they can't quite vote for Mamdani. They can't stand Cuomo. And Sliwa's run a kind of entertaining campaign. I said that, and someone asked me, actually, is that okay if I do that? I said, hey, fine, it's fine. You know what? It's a free country. It's a secret ballot. Pat Moynihan, and after the 76 election, I knew how much Pat liked Gerald Ford, who had appointed him ambassador to the UN, and he respected him personally. He just thought he was a really decent person. And of course, Moynihan had served in the Nixon administration as a counselor and then ambassador to India. So someone asked Moynihan, who do you vote for? Of course, he supported Carter. He was a Democratic Senate candidate in 76, and Carter was the presidential candidate. But someone in a semi-private setting said, well, who'd you really vote for, Pat? And Moynihan said, you know, the Australian ballot, the secret ballot, was a very important innovation in the history of modern democracy. And Moynihan gave like this 10-minute discourse on when the Australian ballot was introduced in the U.S., which I think is like the mid-19th century. I think they had open election. Before that, you like stood in the public and said who you were for, you know what I mean? Oh. And it was very amusing, and he never said who he voted for. So people are entitled to do that. They can just say it's a secret ballot. But I agree, Hillary's—
Sure.
Yes, so just answer it, right, and get it off your chest.
People are entitled to do that. All I'm saying is that the answer that you gave to the Claremont kids is totally normal. It's right. It's just like I don't. This wasn't my first choice. I wouldn't. I think you said I wouldn't have even ranked him. I would have ranked the other center left candidates. There were a bunch of other candidates, and they didn't happen. These guys decided to put all their eggs behind Cuomo, who's a ridiculous choice on personal and policy levels. Right. He was a terrible governor. He seems like a bad person. He seems like he's running a terrible campaign. Well, like, what do you want? And so, the idea that the Democratic leadership can't just say that, I find totally crazy when it's like, this is going to backfire on them, I guess is my point. Like, even if you're of the view that the Zohran wing is like a little dangerous, like you're a little concerned about it, you want to limit their power, you want to control, you're concerned about controlling power for the whatever center left, like more, you know, active, you know, wing when it comes to, you know, more strong military, whatever you, however you want to frame it. Like you want to kind of sideline the Zohran wing, the DSA wing a little bit. You're concerned they're getting too much power. Even from that perspective, the right thing to do is say, I'm for him. Good luck. We'll see how it goes. I've got some concerns. I've been hearing some good things. I hope he pivots to the middle. I've heard him say a lot of good things recently. It seems like he's pivoting more towards the center. We'll see. I support him. I want the best for New York City. I also am enthusiastically behind Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger. Nobody would be upset about that. But what you're doing is you're fucking radicalizing people. I'm seeing it online. The people who are not even DSA, they're kind of soft Zohran supporters. They're more progressive and they're excited about him because he's young, and they now see the entire Democratic leadership, Schumer, Jeffries, Hillary, Kamala, not be able to answer the question. And it makes them all be like, fuck you, Democratic establishment. I'm going to go in for the craziest left winger possible just as a statement that you guys are all cowards. And so they are creating the environment that they're trying to avoid with their weak-kneed answers on this. Like, just have some backbone. Anyway, that's my rant on this.
And also, I mean, I think they're inviting some on the left to not support a moderate Democrat who wins a primary, right, or in the case of Spanberger, for example, in effect was strong enough to shoo away. There would have been progressive challenges to her. She is not where the entire Virginia Democratic Party is, which has its progressives, obviously. But they've rallied to Spanberger, so far as I can tell, and there hasn't been a huge amount of lamenting that our people didn't run or didn't win, or we have an ex-CIA person as our nominee and stuff. One does have to play it both ways. There have to be some limits. Obviously, you can imagine certain people being nominated who we wouldn't. One would just say, I can't support it. Fine, and if that's a matter of conscience, you can't support it, say that, you know? But don't, the ducking is a little bit much. I wonder do you think what Hillary meant by the day after is that she's alluding to the fact that Trump's threatening to cut off funds to New York if Mamdani wins and maybe send in the National Guard. And she's saying we all have to rally to New York City the day after to defend it against Trump. If she's saying that, I agree with that. And I think that's actually an important thing. But again, the people who are being so standoffish so hostile to Mamdani are making it harder to say the day after, okay, he's kept Jessica Tisch, assuming he does, as police commissioner, who the business community likes very much, who's a real centrist. And it's not right. The president does not have the right to unilaterally cut off funds, which he doesn't like the result of a local election, you know. And we need to rally to New York with all the demagoguing Trump and his people are going to do about Mamdani, including I do think they'll find some excuse to send in the National Guard and do all kinds of other things. So
of course they will.
Do you think Hillary was alluding to that with that day after thing?
I can't.
It was a mysterious kind of comment.
You know? Yeah, like her little word salad answer. I just can't get inside her head. It's also like you knew you were going to get asked about this. I have an answer. Maybe she did. And I don't know.
Anyway.
Maybe people should be there. Yeah, for sure. In the day after, I guess, whatever that means. I can't endorse that it was a good thing to say because I don't understand what she meant. Maybe that's what she meant. If so. If she still has a spokesperson, you can email me and I'll clarify people on the podcast tomorrow. Hey, everybody. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you're like me, this time of year might be the time that you'd need some BetterHelp. The shorter days, making things a little bit dismal. I'm getting some sad. That's seasonal affective disorder. And, it affects my mood. I'm fine. Don't worry about me. It's okay. But, folks that are dealing with issues, depression this time of year can make it a little bit worse. And so if that's you, turn to therapy for a little bit of help. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct. They're fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify needs and preferences, and their experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means you typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from the tailored recs. So this month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/thebulwark. That's betterhelp.com/thebulwark. All right, we need to laugh about one last thing. Laugh or cry or be scared. All, maybe, I guess, related to this mayor's race. New York Post article that House Republicans are exploring ways to prevent Zoran Mamdani from being sworn in as mayor if he wins on Tuesday. You might wonder, how could they do, what could they be thinking of? How could they do that? What would be the rationale for trying to prevent Zoran in their, you know, expanding effort to turn us into an authoritarian autocracy? Here's what they're going to cite. The U.S. Constitution's Insurrection Clause, the post-Civil War 14th Amendment to the Constitution, barring from office anyone who is engaged in insurrection or rebellion or has given aid or comfort to the enemies of the nation. I can think of somebody that is engaged in insurrection, that there was an attempt to bar them from the ballot because they actually engaged in insurrection, and all of the right-wingers said that this was an outrageous affront, an anti-democracy. And that was Donald Trump was the person that engaged in, that did an insurrection, attempted an actual insurrection and rebellion against the country. He's the president now, but the House Republicans are saying Mamdani's statements calling to resist ICE could violate the prohibition. I mean, you have to laugh, and it's just like, are you fucking kidding? The 14th Amendment is what you're going to use?
Yeah, that is kind of wonderful, right? The thing they all said, and the Supreme Court said, didn't bar Trump from a federal ballot, which he actually, which was the whole point of it, incidentally, basically to keep them out of federal office mostly. And anyway, it's ludicrous on 8 different levels, of course. And I guess they think it's a good issue for them to just highlight Mamdani and make him the face of the Democratic Party. And a lot of the Democratic centrists are all worried about that. And I've argued with some of them. And then after I was quoted with the Claremont thing, how could he be saying this? You know what? If you don't want Mamdani to be the face of the Democratic Party, make Spanberger and Cheryl and Jason Crow and 5 million other friends of ours the face of the Democratic Party and do a better job of that. That's how you get a face. You don't complain. You could chop down Mamdani's publicity a little bit. I mean, he's going to get a lot of attention. He'll win the election. 2 months later, he'll be mayor of New York. Even a week or two later, it'll all be about the challenges he faces in New York. And he'll be mayor. And then he'll do a good job or a bad job or a mediocre job, or you can criticize him on this issue or that one. And this is your point from 10 minutes ago. They're creating more of an issue here than they would otherwise, right? With all the hand-wringing and lamenting about it. And they're playing into the Republicans' hands. That's this idiotic, now we're going to have some Democrat somewhere, some moderate Democrat who's so concerned about the left, such a danger, so horrible. First they were saying Latinx. Now the one liberal city is going to have a very liberal and anti-Israel, unfortunately, mayor. And it's so horrible that we have to really, can't criticize them. You got to understand where the Republicans are coming from, Tim. This is kind of, wokeness. It's just like, we have Trump because, some college professors did some bad things on campus. Now we're going to have this insane thing because this guy wins it after what? 1 million people vote for him tomorrow, incidentally, right?
I agree with all that. I also want to throw out a good backfire on the Republicans, though, because I don't know. I mean, he's happy. Are you ready for this hot take? He's a better face for the Democratic Party than Hillary. he's at least appealing. There are people that have been not engaged in politics who like him. And so, I don't know. He's not appealing to the median voter in fucking Pennsylvania. I don't know. Some people are excited and engaged. There's something to that. He's certainly more appealing than fucking Mike Johnson or whoever these people are that are trying to keep him off the ballot. The good thing about it is that the Republicans are at least unapologetic about their anti-democratic efforts. Like, we can not Democratic Party, but anti-democracy efforts. We can just see it. Like, anytime, any election they don't like, they're going to try to stop. And that's a good thing to know.
But that is an important point. If I could just take 12 seconds on that. I mean, that they're so disregard the will of the actual voters. I mean, he's going to win tomorrow, presumably. And I don't quite know the numbers. If I get him something close to 1 million votes or 750,000 votes. And they're just going to, throw that. But that shows their deep contempt for democracy. And it fits in with the redistricting. It fits in with the voter suppression. It fits in with all the talk about 26 and 28. And makes me more worried that they will be considered. I mean, who knows how many House Republicans are signed on to this idiotic thing. But there will not be no support in the Republican Party for Trump's efforts to put a major thumb in the scale in 26 and really distort the elections in 2028, don't you think? I mean, that's not just a Trump thing, is what I'm saying. It's now a Republican Party thing.
for sure. I think for sure in 2026. And what exactly it looks like what the extent of it is, you know, all that is TBD. But I keep saying, like, look, they've laid out their playbook. And this other thing is ridiculous. Like, he's going to be seated. And, like, this is just stupid, like, New York Times rage bait. They're not going to be able to use the insurrection clause from keeping him in. But, like, the fact that that's where their mind is important. Because that, to me, I think has always been – that's been my top concern about next year. Is they'll try to do some hinky stuff before the election, whatever that looks like. Obviously, they're doing the redistricting. Who knows what else they'll try to do as far as voter suppression is concerned. But I always just kind of, that stuff a lot of times backfires more than it actually works. But if the Democrats win, particularly if it's close, they're going to do this shit. Oh, I can't seat this person, the mail-in ballots, this clause, and some fucking thing. You know what I mean? Whatever pretextual reason they come up with, that is coming next year. And I mean, unless Democrats win by like 30 seats or something. But I think that if it's at all close, that's what's coming.
And the failure to seat Grijalva is really of a piece for that unprecedented. I mean, more than a month after she wins the election, she's certified. And Mike Johnson's using this fake excuse that they're not in session when he's sworn at other people in the pro forma sessions. Yeah, so again, right. It's just a minor thing. I mean, it would be the 218th signature on the Epstein discharge petition, obviously, but otherwise there's no votes. So it doesn't matter in some sense that much, except the voters don't have a member of Congress to call up and get their, you know, some help on something. But the voters of that district.
Meaningful now because there's a lot of services that are being lost.
Right. No, but so it isn't so. Nothing. But mostly it's again, an indication of how far they're willing to go. Eesh. 2026 could be rough in a lot of ways.
Aish.
It's hard to be run a democracy when one of the two parties isn't really committed to democracy. You know?
Indeed it is. Indeed it is, Bill Kristol. Tomorrow night, everybody, we are going to be live on YouTube. I think it's at 8 Eastern that you got Sam Stein and friends with Bill. I'm going to pop on with Sarah and JVL, I think around 9:15 or 9:30. So go to the Bulwark YouTube page, subscribe to us then. And that will be tomorrow night, Tuesday night, November 4th. We've got a great podcast lined up for you for Election Day tomorrow as well. It'll be a little doubleheader. So we'll see you all back there tomorrow morning. Bill, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
All right. Everybody else, see you on Election Day. Peace. We got the back. The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.